A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Germany podcast. I'm Travis Dow, but today I'm not alone because this is actually a crossover podcast with the Lesser Bonapartes. How's it going, guys?
Going quite well. I learned some German for the occasion. I thought I'd share that with you, Travis.
Oh boy. Are my ears going to bleed? No.
I've been practicing it. And so if I ever go to Germany, this is going to be the only thing I ever say to anybody.
All right. Looking forward to that. It's good.
Wer will ein Schneiderweiss?
Is Schneiderweisse your favorite beer or something? Is that
yeah, it's my favorite.
Or did you see that on a poster?
No, it just sounded
really German, so I wanted to work that in.
Yeah,
I guess we should say our names. I'm Daniel from Lesser Bonapartes,
and I'm Glenn. And
okay,
there we go. But I have already dazzled. Dazzled Travis with some of the German I'm trying to learn. I am going to make it my mission to throughout the next couple of months learn how to order 9 different kinds of German beer.
Well, now wait a minute. That's easy, because if you know 9 German beer brands, then you just have to say ich möchte and whatever. Yeah. Augustina.
Pilsner. Ich möchte St. Pauli girl. You guys have that?
Oddly enough, I've never actually seen that in Hamburg.
Really? I was to understand it was the most authentic of all German beers with that blonde lady on it.
Ich miste Milwaukee's best ice.
Hey, if you've listened to my beer episode, you know that's not even called beer on the History of Germany podcast. You can call it I don't know, ale or malt liquor, but like there's laws in Germany. You can't
They have to follow Reinheitsgebot, right? Don't they?
Yeah. Exactly. There you go.
Exactly.
We have Travis on the show because over on History of Germany, he's actually getting up to Charlemagne, which is where we were ending up with our Frankish series. And first of all, thank you very much again, Travis, for coming in and rapping with us. Because and I already used the word rapping with us. God, I'm a lame English teacher. But anyway, I guess for all you boners at home, we are looking for. I guess just to sort of give you the modus operandi here, we're just going to kind of have a chat. We're not really going to tell you like the straight dope like story A, B, C, D about Charlemagne, partly because it's a terrifyingly giant story. We've already poured so much work into the Franks that we were kind of like, you know, we want to do something special to round it out. And you can't talk about Franks and not talk about Charlemagne. But at the same time, like, you know, it's fun to bring someone else in and kind of yak about Charlemagne. So I'm going to ask you guys a question. All right. What do you think Charlemagne's favorite cloak looked like? And that was a weird question. And I just the blank stares
Wait
of
a
you
minute.
Guys just looking at me. Because, like, what kind of man do you think Charlemagne was like when he was getting dressed in the morning, you know?
It was purple, because he was like, kind of trying to be... Wait, was he even trying to be a Roman emperor already? Like, was he... It was a purple cloak. Come on, it's a trick question. It's too easy.
I guess it does have to be. I was thinking something like I was thinking something like a lot of gold trim, like I don't know, has like embroidery says Rex Francorum across the back, like a boxer coming in the ring. Because he's a big fucking deal.
The gold embroidered, gold embroidered boxer's cloak. That
that would about do it.
He's got the build for it.
Sorry, go ahead, Glenn.
Okay, I want to know. Okay, you might have had it, but I guess the first thing I'd like to settle this, Daniel. I think a good way in with this whole topic is that I want to ask first, since we have both I guess schools of thought in the room. Does Charlemagne belong to the Germans or the French? Before we continue,
absolutely.
No. Thank you, Travis.
Well, oh, wait, did I ruin it?
No.
I meant to say the Germans, obviously. Yeah,
make the argument, Travis. I want to hear it.
Ooh, I mean, what's the argument? The truth is that I wouldn't really argue either way. Both claim him rightfully, but if you're gonna make the argument, bottom line is, if you had a time machine and you could, and he opened his mouth and he said words, what language do you think would come out of his mouth? Mein Herr, ich glaube, das hört sich etwas so an, and it's not very French sounding.
Yeah, because I think he would have been like the. Something that we learned on our Frankish series is that there's actually some, like, the Rhineland dialects in modern day Germany are kind of more or less similar to what Charlemagne himself would have been speaking, because he was derived from that Austrasian lobe.
Yeah, that's my understanding. Yeah. Almost like,
okay.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, like that Plattdeutsch is like as close as we could get is to that old, like, I've seen it written and it's like almost a foreign language. It's like, it's old. It's old Middle German or something. So in that sense, German has changed so much since his time that you could say it was a different language, and French has done the same. So that's my own counter argument. Damn it.
That's good that we bring that up then, because was there even really, I guess we could say at this time, a German identity, quote unquote,
no.
As a way in? I mean, so I guess am I getting this correct, Travis? There were numerous German dialects at the time. Such as like Swabian or whatever.
Yeah. And then, Bavarians and now compare that to like Gallo-Roman Gaul.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, totally.
Which would have been,
yeah.
I guess, more or less more inter-somethingable. Understandable. I don't know.
Yeah, they would have been a mix of stuff, but they would know who they are. They're like, we're Gallo-Roman, whatever that means.
Right.
I mean, yeah, they would have a much more self-identity than the various Germanic tribes. If you're talking about each specific tribe, that's different. Like the Franks, the Franks definitely knew that they were Franks, and they liked other Frankish clans, and they all worked together. You know, Saxons were the same way, but yeah, Germans, no. In the way that we see it today, they all hated each other, they all fought each other, they could barely understand each other at the time.
Which I guess makes it all the more, I guess, interesting to me, sort of thinking about Charlemagne ruling over, because I guess we should also say, like, Charlemagne came to power in 768, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a couple few decades after where Glenn and I left off our story with Charles Martel. But he's ended up, you know, he inherits the vastly more unified kingdom that Charles Martel, you know, left to his son Pepin, and then Pepin leaves it to Charlemagne and Charlemagne's brother Carloman, who conveniently mm-hmm. dies very early on.
Right.
So here we have Charlemagne ruling over like what amounts to the entirety of like Western Christendom, except for like Italy and the British Isles, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess like something that's cool to me about Charlemagne, I guess I'm sort of subtly shifting into a part of the show where we talk about what we admire about Charlemagne. but he actually like had the fact that he was able to maintain this kind of sense of authority, you know, however rickety it was at times. And I know he had to like crack down a bit over this realm that spanned from, you know, the Pyrenees all the way across that whole Northern European arc into, the borders of the old, I guess this realm ended up extending to the borders of the old, like, East Germany, right? So it was, like, mostly, like, West Germany.
And, yeah, you know, exactly.
And that's,
well, yeah,
because
then it depends, because every year he tried to fight further east. And so it almost depends on whether you're talking about spring or fall. Seriously, every year. The border was that, you know, you beat the Saxons back, and they'd come right back the next, you know, next spring or whatever, and he'd have to go back again. So, yeah, you know. But yeah, I would say, you could say like kind of, yeah, border between East and West Germany. That's a good way to look at it in his lifetime. So.
I don't know. Sorry, Glenn, you look thoughtful.
No. I'm very skeptical of all this Charlemagne horseshit, because I think that. Well, I mean, so he's a national hero in Germany and to some extent France. But I think that this was a desperate ploy by both him, Charlemagne, and the papacy at the time, which was in kind of a ruinous, kind of fallen into a bit of a ruinous calamity. And they both needed something real solid in order to secure, like I said, how are we going to subdue all these disparate tribes? How are we going to sweep away these final remnants of paganism? We got Saracens knocking at our door. If you listen to the last episode, we have the Moors that are trying to kind of probe into southern Gaul at the time. So how do we officially, stand up, flex some nuts, and say, Rome is back, baby? Well, we have to, and then what did that even mean by the year 800? I mean, what is, I guess they could kind of look to Constantinople for some sort of a guideline as to how to behave Romany, but they needed to kind of come back and unite things in a big way if the whole kingdom was going to hold together, because it was always falling apart. We had all these, like we talked about, these succession rules that for some reason stated that you had to divide your kingdom up equally amongst all your sons.
Which even Pepin did it too with Carloman and shit. Like it even after spending your whole, like with Clovis, like you spend your whole damn life like centralizing everything, and then
but that's just how it was.
Custom,
like,
is custom.
You know how all your grandfathers killed all your great uncles? Yeah. You know how all your dad had to kill all your uncles? Well, you're going to have to do that too, son. There's just no way around it. That's just how the Franks operate. What the hell? Like, yeah, it took them hundreds of years to figure that out. Oh, just give it to one son. That's already bad enough. That's already risky enough.
Son, sit down. I've written into my will that all your uncles are going to try to kill you in about a month.
Yeah. No way to prepare you. You're gonna be severely mentally like damaged, but if you survive at all.
I declare upon my death a civil war. Who cares? I'm gonna die. Who cares? These kind of fracturous succession rules made everything, I had to be so redundant, so fracturous that the center wasn't holding anymore, right? Yeah. Because, like we've said, a few times now, this type of, real politik made the Lombards fracture into 35 different warring kingdoms in Italy. Knocking at the Pope's door, he did all he could to try to placate them. France was always so divided, the Visigoths always so divided, that the Moors had no trouble just waltzing in and taking over whatever they wanted to. So this had to change in order for anything to kind of stabilize in any meaningful way. There are just too many outside threats now, particularly with the Moors. The Moors are awesome pirates. They all put on their pirate hat, got a little parrot, and decided they were just going to turn the Mediterranean into their own private lake. These German barbarians, not the most seafaring folk at the time. Yeah. So they really had no protection against that at all, unless they really wanted to unify in a big way. And what better way to do that than behind the church, like we learned all the way back during the era of Constantine. Now we have, so with all these, with all these desperate threats, we have Rome essentially beginning to take kind of these votes of no confidence against the Pope. This comes to a head with Pope Leo III, and hey, why don't we make a deal, you and I? We kind of like, I don't know. I think it was political maneuvering more than any way to bring back the Roman Empire. And that's really the only kind of baseline we had to go off on the time, really, is, well, what's the only empire that we can really point to? Well, look at that crumbling aqueduct over there. Let's say we're bringing that back, and then.
We're bringing sexy back in a big way.
Yeah. We're bringing sexy back, but it would be, I guess,
bringing Rexy back? No, that's not it. Sorry.
But I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the common people would have thought of us at the time. Oh, hey guys, did you hear Rome's coming back? What great. You put the bread in the oven, and then
what did the Byzantine Empire think of that whole situation? All of Charlemagne and him being crowned emperor. I mean, they're sitting there like, what is going on? Who? I mean,
I think there was
a Roman emperor that isn't even crowned. Yeah, I mean, it's just weird.
Right. It would have almost seemed like children play acting.
Very much so.
Romanitas. But I think
isn't that cute? Yeah, look what you guys are doing in the old imperial city.
It was convincing enough that Irene tried to. Was it Irene who sent the marriage proposal to Charlemagne, or was it like the Pope who sent it to Irene? But I think there was at least like talks to actually marry Charlemagne to the Empress Dowager there in Byzantium to unify the empires, which, you know, I don't know how well that would have gone over at the wedding. I don't think the bride side and the groom's side might not have really mixed.
Later German kings tried this a lot. Like there are Byzantine queens in the Holy Roman Empire for that exact reason. Like there's that.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we have the papal authority in Rome. Check. Okay. Now we need the actual Romans that are still in Constantinople. Okay. Let's be powerful enough that we can marry one of their daughters. Okay. Check. Okay. Now we can really pretend to be emperor here. You know, now we got it.
And
my wife
speaks
Greek. That's awesome.
Yeah, if only we can get our actual neighbors to listen to us and we say that we are, you know, legit.
Yeah, but I mean, it was a pretty sweet gig. Like, they both... So, the Charlemagne needed the Pope to become emperor, although that's argued, because he kind of wanted to crown himself and not want to rely on the Pope. But the Pope clearly
needed
Charlemagne,
learned that lesson.
So... yeah. That was... That's actually one of the funnier Charlemagne stories, is that... Like, the Pope almost tricked him into, you know, they were at a, because it wasn't supposed to be a coronation. It was a, like, the Christmas Eve Mass or something. And then when he knelt in front of the nativity scene, Pope's all like, bam! Oh, and hey, you're emperor now. I did it. You all saw it. I did it. He kneeled in front of me. And I mean, it was like surprise coronation. Like, Charlemagne was upset, according to... Well, so there's... One source says he was upset. Another one says that already before he was... before he was crowned emperor, people... There was some letters where he was hailed as emperor. So, like, he already... So, like, I mean, he was going to do it either way. So there's all kinds of... But just that one act.
I think I'm more apt to believe that one, because that was sort of... That was sort of the bit, wasn't it? Like, going back to all the way to the high Roman Empire, is that, oh, we crown you emperor, sir. And you go, no, me. Come on, not me. No.
Exactly. No, that is also.
Travis is so much more qualified than me to be emperor. He deserves the crown more than me. And everyone goes, no, it's you. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
So
if
there,
you
there
insist.
There is evidence for that, too, because they met beforehand. When the Pope actually had to ask for his help, he went to Charlemagne. You know, so they had already met, and so there must have been a negotiation, right? Like, okay, well, march to Italy. What do I get for it? So,
not only was the Pope dealing with the rebellion in Rome, but he finally wanted the Lombards the hell out of there. Right.
So that's exactly.
Well,
actually,
Glenn, that's what I was going to kind of mention. That one thing I think is interesting about this whole setup is that, okay, think of the various titles that Charlemagne has at this point. What I think is pretty interesting is that he is sort of more or less like a basic main title that he's working with is Rex Francorum, okay? Mm-hmm. King of the Franks. Not King of France, not King of Frankland, but King of these people, the Franks.
Of the people, right.
Right, but when he goes into Italy, you know, at the Pope's behest, you know, to help out there and, you know, get the Lombards under control, the title that he gets there is it's King of Italy, like the geographical feature instead of the people.
And but he changed
he's not
that.
King of the Italians.
It was first King of the Lombards, and then that was actually like public relations thing. So it was King of the Lombards, and then in his own lifetime he changed it to King of Lombardy, and then King of the Italians to King of Italy, and the Franks. Yeah, and it was Charlemagne, all the regions of Germany, even Lombardy and Italy, all those regions. Before then, it was like, okay, I conquer you. Now my Frankish realm is just bigger.
Right.
Because Charlemagne was like, no, I want to collect titles. I want to be King of Burgundy. I want to be King of Saxony. I want to be King of Italy. I want to be, you know, and yeah, I mean, so, and all those, King of Frisia and all those regions, it's kept their name because he tied the king of the title to the land.
Yeah.
Burgundians are from like almost the Ukrainian border, and yet Burgundy is in France because that's where the Franks took them over and claimed.
Right,
to
that's
be,
where the Burgundians landed in time for the Franks to conquer their asses.
Exactly. Yeah. Same as the Lombards. They're from miles and miles away, but Lombardy is in Italy because that's where the Franks killed them. Yeah. That's like the chalk outline. Literally, like the original names of Europe are all just chalk outlines where Charlemagne or Karl Martel or the Franks marched through. And Saxony is where it is because, yep, you guessed it.
That's where we stopped. That's an excellent, excellent metaphor. That's the chalk outlines of.
Yeah, I think it works. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think it's telling, though, is that, the Pope originally gave him the title Emperor of Rome, and he kind of walks that back a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And changes the title to Emperor Governing the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
So yes, he didn't. Even that was a bridge too far to call him the Roman Emperor, right, at the time. Because what's Rome? We don't have a Rome anymore. And if there is a Roman Empire, it's the guy in Constantinople. He was smart enough to know that.
And I like that hair splitting about, like, well, you're not Roman Emperor, but you're an emperor who's in charge of Rome. It's like being assistant to the regional manager.
Yeah.
He really is.
I think you're the emperor of all the Romans. If you can find one, you're the emperor of them. Go. Right. Yeah. I mean,
yeah. I think what's just sort of talking about like administrative stuff, which I know is just makes for thrilling radio. but one thing in some of my researches that I thought was really interesting is that, so for a long time I've been kind of curious about the sort of the transition from like the old the late antiquity, early Middle Ages, sort of shambling, zombie corpse of Roman administration evolving into the feudal system, and like where that actually. And it turns out like Charlemagne was like a real fulcrum of that. And I had no idea that the system of counties, as we know it in Western Europe, was a Charlemagne thing. Because it kind of he took the model
pre and post Charlemagne as far as that kind of thing, like nobility and counties and the way you would have to pay an oath, to your emperor.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's pre and post. And Charlemagne is the guy that basically changed it for until the 19th century in Germany. I mean, it's crazy.
That he made it a, you're right. It became less of a matter of like, I guess in the Roman system, it was like, well, you follow the guy who's in charge because it's the law. But it became...
Yeah, it was more like a taxation, or like I pay the government and therefore I have land. Right. It was more like what we have in modern day. Whereas Franks were like, it's more like a mafia. Like, you pay me protection money and, I'll let you keep your land. And, when I need help, you help out. And, whenever we're going to go do this hit on these guys over here, you got to join in and... we'll all share the loot and sharing the loot became so critical because it was all a direct relationship with the king or the direct relationship with the guy above you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was doesn't that kind of get into my favorite dry as dust term? Isn't this kind of the beginning too then of what we becomes kind of the investiture controversies of whether or not we put secular or religious people in charge of these various administrative offices?
Yeah, like who gets to put who in charge of the bishoprics, which then the line wasn't really very clear cut between.
Oh, this becomes so messy. I think France is better, but in Germany, the Holy Roman Empire, I'm like trying to figure out, if you're trying to figure out like, okay, who pays, like who is whose boss? Because can have a prince bishop who can be in total revolt against the Pope and that's okay. How can that be okay? So he doesn't have, you have clerics that are landholders. You have. So they're in the chain somewhere. You have church people in the chain of command between the nobility, and you might have higher people than them and lower people than them, but they're, they're also a duke or a count and a bishop.
And I have to think like Charlemagne.
Starts there.
Yeah.
That starts with I don't want to be crowned. Oh, you, it's just, yeah.
I think another thing I learned about was like these the religious reforms that, and again, like I was actually very surprised to, because I guess I'm a child of so much of my own autodidactic research and sort of the research that Glenn and I have done for Lesser Bonapartes, where we come to discover like all these people who were supposed to have done this or that actually were just sort of riding the wave. But with Charlemagne, I'm kind of leaning toward he actually did this shit, because I was reading about how it was like Charlemagne led the charge to reform the like the monastic system, even.
Yes.
And like, and he had the authority even to do that. And also he was the one who like basically was like, look, you guys have gotten like way mission creep here. You're way off target. If you're going to call yourself a monk, then by God, live by the rule of Saint Benedict. And plant your ass here in this abbey, and don't, because apparently you would just wander around, and you were just like a guy, but you're also a monk, you know, who knows? And the idea that, like, Charlemagne was very concerned about finally, like nailing that jello to the wall and being like, okay, you're in this category now. This is what we're doing, and this is what we're going to do for the next 500 years.
And and those categories stuck. It was it was nobility, the peasant, and the clerics, the church. And that was just, that was it. I mean, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say that it did yield some positive benefits, because I wanted to lead that into some of these reforms he made. And I guess we can say where some of the positivity did come from that. I know I've been skeptical here, but these demands for standards and some kind of standardization and standards and practices and best practices amongst these monks in these abbeys led to a revolution in learning, Daniel. I know this is the stuff you love talking
about.
Ooh,
yes, intellectual history.
Intellectual history. Before that, it was kind of the Wild West in terms of intellectual thought. Everybody just kind of did whatever they felt like, because there was no real hard and fast rules between how we either copied out or wrote new manuscript until these various experiments and standardization and best practices led to what we call today Carolingian minuscule.
Your school handwriting.
Yes, that's another your school handwriting.
But it's pretty cool. Like, you see these manuscripts, like you see images of these manuscripts written in Carolingian minuscule, and it's clear as day. Like, you can read it. I mean, well, you know, I can't understand the Latin, but
if you're used to it, you have to get used to it. But yeah, no, it is. It's always the same. That was the key.
Yeah.
Yeah. Monastic reforms, that is worth emphasizing, because out of those, you can like directly get... several universities in Germany come from that one reform, and the University of Paris, that kind of first started as a, you know, Charlemagne chartered but church run sort of thing that, turned into these Europeans' oldest and greatest universities, basically. So that's a real reform. I think no one before did that. Like, he wasn't riding a wave on that one. That was like willpower. Right. Like, I want, you guys, I'm going to make you all read. No, we don't. What? No, you're going to read. Do your homework. That was like force of will. And just standardizing everything goes as part of that. The other really innovative thing, and like this is also, again, like, okay, maybe he just... because he created the, or he expanded the Frankish law. I don't know if he actually created it, or was that Charles Martel? I don't remember. But Charlemagne greatly expanded Frankish law, and kind of, it's not, still not categorized, and it's still all over the place as far as laws go. But it's definitely there. Yeah, I don't think there's older. There's a lot around the same time. So as soon as he did the Lex Francorum, then there's the the Saxon one is like, there's a Frisian one, Burgundian one, many others. But that one, but there were others before. So maybe he was riding a wave.
He may have been riding the wave, but what's kind of interesting, like even with Charlemagne, like aside from like riding the wave or force of will or not, is that he surrounded himself with a lot of very capable people. And this is an angle that I think is really interesting about his career, because you had, of course, the famous Alcuin, he really assembled like a dream, an international dream team of scholars, which is really
seriously
cool.
In his court, that would have just any day of the week. It just would have been so cool to be there.
Yeah, there was like Alcuin and this fellow Theophold, who I didn't get a chance to read up on him as much as I would have wanted to, but I thought his background was pretty interesting, because his family were living in Gaul, but they were like second generation refugees from the Moorish invasions, and they had held on to their Gothic identity in Gaul. Like they were still like, oh well, we're you know we're Visigoths, thank you very much, not right. Franks or Gallo-Romans. Yep. But so this, you had this Theophold who was like part of this, and Alcuin. And one thing that I wanted to run by both Glenn and you, Travis, because I can't quite believe this, but I saw some sources crediting Alcuin himself with developing the Trivium and Quadrivium curriculum for like medieval universities. Like, he was the guy who said, this is what we're gonna do now. Like, he didn't necessarily create it himself, but he was like, this is gonna be the standard.
I think what that is that I've read some of that too. It's kind of like when people are like, oh haha, Al Gore invented the internet, and then you go, no, what Al Gore did was sponsored legislation that led to the internet as we know it today being created.
Right.
That's kind of the same thing with Alcuin.
Yeah, he was the biggest name at that time. Could be,
Right.
But yeah, I couldn't really Alcuin give a definitive
answer. Alcuin kind of rubber stamped a lot of the stuff that was sort of that was sort of already kind of like, you know, Caroline Minuscule can't be attributed to any one person. It was kind of this natural unfolding. And then finally someone comes along and says, okay, rubber stamp, this is what we're doing. And that's Alcuin.
It had
Alcuin's, stop changing it. No one changed it from now on.
The seal of quality, like the Nintendo seal.
Like the Nintendo seal of quality right there. That's how you knew that this, you know, this was the good one. This is the one that had Duck Hunt and Metroid on it. You know, that one, like... So you know, you were just like, okay, so Alcuin is kind of the guy, because he was kind of all these monastic channels all went through him.
Yeah.
So he gets a lot of that.
And it's again some of that standardizing, because I think that was another aspect of the, what's called the, I guess we should say for the listeners, this is all called the Carolingian Renaissance in the historiography, which, you know, which might be overblowing it a little bit, but also, but it might not be, because it was a very... And again, here you have the kind of like force of will thing, because with, you know, Charlemagne and his, you know, main man Alcuin, the idea really was to standardize the texts that you could have available at all these monasteries around in your realm, so that you could actually teach the priests how to read goddamn Latin, because that's their job and they couldn't do it.
Yeah.
So they had these scriptoria making like official, like copying out essential texts, like mass producing them as much as they could be mass produced in the 800s. Of these texts to send out, which is a really cool aspect too.
Well, I've heard things that say that Caroline Minuscule is one of the reasons that we have any classical sources now, because it was finally more time efficient to copy out. Yeah, like, you know, because these things were getting destroyed. They were basically wiping their ass with copies of Ptolemy's biography at this point. and it was like what is that? You know, Archimedes on sphere making? Let me blow my nose into that and throw it out the window. And then they didn't care anymore, because, you know, there just wasn't time efficient. They had to spend, you know, the bulk of their time copying out, you know, Christian religious text. But Caroline Minuscule, was basically like the, you know, now we have kind of like a text speak to write all this stuff out.
Right.
So we can, so now we can just make it more efficient and quicker. So we can start doing some of that. What's a little bit of that? You know, I'll get a little bit of this, you know, the Anabasis of Alexander and in between, you know, but now we have kind of a reason to start copying this stuff out, is because now it's more worth our while to do so, because we don't have to worry about, you know, hey, let me go find whatever, you know, secret decoder ring will translate this Abbey's writing into mine, you know.
That was a problem. What Dan just said about priests not being able to speak Latin, actually, or not even, I mean, that was actually a serious problem. There was enough nobility that had gotten their posts, either bought their posts or gotten their posts just because they're nobility, that, you know, education wasn't even really a requirement anymore, but holding mass was. So they would, you know, stand up there and just kind of mumble through a half memorized Ave Maria or something. And chroniclers of the time like, wrote that down, like, this is shameful. What is going on? You know, this is...
Get up there and just going, and the rockets red glare, and lots of bombs in the
air. Like, do you even care anymore? Like, just completely given up. Just no.
But you gotta think, what's Odo the peasant, you know, dirt farming idiot, gonna know the difference? You know?
You go up there and be like,
if he makes it look good, yeah, just do the right hand movements and in the right tone, and you'll never know.
There once was a savior from Nantucket, and then. And then they're all just going to go like, wow, yeah, okay, I did my duty. I went to church today now.
Sing it and say amen, and it sounds good. It's all right.
Yeah.
That was part of the saving of these old Latin texts also, Glenn, is that because of that educational push, they started keeping an eye out for texts that were written in Latin that could be like pedagogical tools, basically, like texts mm-hmm. that were, the Latin was clear enough that you could sort of teach people how to read and write it by using these texts. And that's why we get you have stuff like Julius Caesar's, Gallic conquests, which is, was used in I mean, it's a cliche that, every Latin student starts out Gaul is divided into three parts, but that's because it was written in a style and with a vocabulary that made it a good pedagogical tool, right? Some of that stuff survived that way,
right? Well, that's why we learned too. I read that's how we have so much goddamn Xenophon, is that he wrote such
so matter of fact.
He wrote so matter of fact and simply and directly that his work was very easily translated.
Yeah.
So we have, that's why we have like 25 surviving Xenophon writings and no primary sources on Alexander the Great, because it's just like.
If you had this really articulate, flowery way of talking, then I'm like, how do I say that word in Persian? Sorry, I'm not going to even try. Don't care.
throw it on. Okay, that's going on the chamber pot pile. Like, fuck it.
That's a chamber pot pile.
Yep. Oh, he just said, the sky is blue. Oh, I can say that. Yeah, sure. I'll translate that in 10 languages.
That's an angle of that medieval bottleneck of texts that have been passed on from antiquity that I had not really thought all that much about before reading about the Carolingian Renaissance. That there was ones not only did you have okay, we're not going to care that much about ones that are antithetical to Christianity. We're not going to care that much about ones that, for whatever reason seem too esoteric or whatever. And also I didn't even think about the sheer laziness aspect. Like, we're not going to bother copying down the one side. It's too hard.
It's too hard. Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. I think about how much we lost just because they're like, oh god, I got this thing later. I really don't have time for this. Okay,
it's already it's matins already. Jesus,
yeah, that's matins. Oh geez, I'm late for dinner. My wife's gonna kill me. What's that? What's this? 50 pages on Xenophon's How to Name Your Dog. Let's do that. Okay. you're on Xenophon on horseback riding. That sounds great. Let's see. I'm gonna go ahead and just. And that we have to thank the Caroline minuscule
for all that
kind of stuff. We also, I want to get into kind of the problematic stuff here, guys. If we don't mind, I guess you could say I asked the question earlier. When does kind of this disparate amalgamation of warring tribes who have been warring since the dawn of friggin' time end? And Germanness sort of begin, and a lot of the kind of the year zero I read about is like we were saying earlier, when Charlemagne finally snuffs out Saxon hegemony, I'll say, in the German territories.
Yeah,
pagan hegemony, in which he was gave everybody a choice, right? He was pretty fair about it. You could convert or die,
right?
and then wipes him out because, of course, he had the biggest army of the time. He was going down Mad Max's Fury Road with the largest army of the right now. Right. And so what were you going to do to stop him? He had the backing of the Pope. He had pretty much unlimited cash at this time because of all this, all these Pope bucks he's getting funneled into his armies.
Pope land fun bucks.
Pope, when you go into the carnival, you have to exchange your money for Pope bucks.
For Pope tokens. Travis, you may have something to speak to this. Like, how much of an organized polity were the Saxons? Like, was this an actual kingdom of sorts he was facing up against? You made a noise like that.
Well, can of worms. So they weren't. They were completely. Here's the thing: is later there became a charismatic leader who rose and joined all the Saxons, but really in defense of Charlemagne, in defense of the Franks. The Franks every summer looted Saxon land, captured people, forced converted them at sword point, you know, and burned villages, murdered women and children, and then went back home to their winter quarters. And if the Saxons came back, they did it again the next year for 30 years. So Saxons became more and more united because they had to defend their, you know, this was, I mean, Franks were aggressive. And so, I mean, if you just read, I mean, the Franks will definitely have you believe that it's the Saxons that are the evil barbarians. And Charlemagne was expanding on all sides. It wasn't,
seems,
you know,
mildly ironic that you have like the Franks accusing other people of being the rotten barbarians that they have to smash.
But they do. Yeah. They're like, oh, we got to go in there. But and a lot of times, yeah. I mean, so Charlemagne, you know, as his casus belli was kind of, okay, well, they're not Christian. And I have the Pope's, you know, the Pope called me the, you know, defender of the faith. So I have to go off in all directions and defeat these pagans. And he maybe really saw that as his mission. I mean, he did send out missionary trips and all that, but was it a way of pacifying the people? Or, like, yeah, there's theories that the Romans just kind of did that.
But, Travis, is there a difference between honest missionary feeling and, you know, politically useful pacifying? Like,
I mean,
it's one
going
the
out there in the
point.
Sword. Yeah, that was...
Yeah,
if the missionaries go out in Africa today and with swords, and I think they'll tell you there's a difference.
Well, right. I mean, in the mind of Charlemagne,
it's like Christian, it's like Christian jihad on the
Right, right. I mean, to us, it's very clear, but I just mean to sort of get in like the headspace of Charlemagne. Like, was it the kind of thing where this conveniently lines up for him?
Maybe that just didn't matter. Exactly. Yeah. But there were stories of, okay, you have 1,000 people in a village and they all get slaughtered just as a warning to the others. Or you have 1,000 people that are slaughtered because, or that are forced converted, you know?
Yeah.
So, that's rough.
I guess it's most famously done to the Saxons, but I know that Charlemagne, he expanded the realms of the Franks all the way to like what's modern day Hungary. So he was butting up against what was left of the Avars and the Slavs.
Yeah.
So was that more... And I guess I'm asking you, Travis, because that's... or Glenn, I don't know if you encountered this in what you're reading. Were those campaigns like sort of the missionary style as well? Or is that more like, let's go smash some half-human barbarians and take their stuff just straight up? Because
in some of those campaigns, he actually went through the Saxons to get to them, really. I don't know if they were just so successful that they kept going. Like, maybe they were chasing Saxons and ended up in Slavic or Avar land.
Yeah.
But I know that there were, you know, specific attacks against some Slavs, but that's the thing is, yeah, I think he's just, oh, well, they're all pagan. The other thing is, Saxons and Franks spoke dialects that, you know, would sound familiar to each other. Okay. Whereas Avars, I would think, but this is kind of speculation that to a Frank, they would say, okay, well, they're pagans. In fact, you know, Franks remember being pagans. It's not living memory, but you know, they all know the stories and, you know, so they know who Wodan is and these, and even the Saxon version, Saxnot, is still just Odin or, you know, Thor, sure. Really. And, you know, they know these gods, even if they're not pagan anymore, but the Slavs speak something they cannot understand at all, and the Avars. And so maybe there was a difference. Maybe they hated the Saxons more because they saw you should be with us and you're not, which doesn't make any sense. But yeah, who knows? I mean, I seriously believe he just went out in every direction. He just, you know, there's an ocean there, can't go there, let's go that way.
Right. I mean, he would have been running. I think he would have had to have known that it's time to turn back at eventually because one, he didn't want to step on too many Byzantine toes.
Right.
And two, he was really just heading out into that wild west of Eastern Europe that existed at the time, and I think he would have been way too far beyond his
way out of his comfort zone.
but his scope of influence, because the Avars and whatever the Kievan Rus that would have been hanging around at the time didn't know from the Pope. They didn't care what his bona fides were. Nah. And two, he would have been just so stretched beyond his supply lines and everything at that time that just militarily, I don't think it got to a point where, okay, now we're spreading the butter a little too thin on the bread. I think we need to head back and just kind of focus on our Saxons, everything. Because, you never...
well, they're right next door.
Wait a minute. Was he worried about his supply lines, or was he worried about, like, wait, how many sons did he have? I got 3 sons. I gotta conquer an empire big enough so that they won't necessarily fight each other. I mean, you know, the Frankish mindset has to be weird in that regard. Like, you're a king, like, oh boy, oh, I got 6 sons. I better go out a conquering. Wife, I'll be home. I gotta go kill some Saxons.
He might have, but I mean, as far as I know, he never tried to cross the channel into Anglo-Saxon kind of English territory. Mm-hmm. Though,
that's true. Like, was it easier to go all the way to Hungary than just hop across the channel, I guess?
But they were Christians.
Okay. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, there was already missionaries going back and forth. He sent missionaries. There were missionaries back and forth from the continent, so... Yeah,
that's true. Alcuin himself was a Northumbrian, so that there was already a major.
So there was somehow
Christianity. Yep. Yeah,
that's the direction, I guess. Maybe they were just really afraid of water, so the channel was enough. I don't know.
They were just superstitious. Yeah. Well, I think I think bringing up splitting the empire among his sons is, I guess, a good point to talk about. Like, and that's what he fucking did. God damn it! Again. So I'm sorry, Travis. I don't know if we can drop those F-bombs on your show.
He got we don't really filter our language. Do you? I've dropped a few. I guess we could have Andrew beep some of these.
In worst case, I'll beep him, but I'm not.
Okay, because I mean, he even got his. You know, like in the '80s when like Frank Sinatra would show up at various colleges and get like an honorary doctorate. Charlemagne actually.
Where the hell are you going with this?
No, because was it Maurice was the emperor? Who was the emperor in 1812, Daniel? I always say 18. That's my other thing. Sorry, Travis. I always say 18 when I mean 8.
I actually remember that from this show. That's all right.
Okay. So who is the
can't remember. Okay. Yeah.
Who cares?
Yeah, because then it goes. Yeah, yeah. I don't.
Emperor Bob over there, and Bob the Emperor over there in Constantine Land. Says officially recognizes Charlemagne's title in 812 ACE. I didn't say 18. So he gets his honorary doctorate from Constantinople University, gives a little speech, and his title is officially recognized. So why, after all of that, all those backdoor deals I did with the Pope Leo over there, all of this fighting, I did 30 years of nonstop war, again with the just dividing up the kingdom at the end.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
At some point, you can't get out. Oh, so Charlemagne, actually, I kind of think that Charlemagne himself couldn't get out of it because he was a lawmaker. And some of his laws, so the Franks were some of the first to say that the king is not above the law. So you can't be a Frank and then be the first to say the king is not above the law and then say, oh, but I'm going to change the law about my sons. Because the second, third, and fourth born, they're going to kill you first. And then, so I think Charlemagne was stuck. Why it didn't happen before or later, it's just crazy. You know, in retrospect, you're like, seriously, what the heck, you know? But yeah, no,
But yeah, so it gets...
it was still a Frankish, because in Germany then, obviously, they did stop it. And it was a Frankish king that stopped it. But the first thing that happened was the son that became king, I'm going to say the wrong thing, but basically was, the son that they sent into the monastery, as soon as the dad died, he came back and killed the brother that was king, and nothing changed.
Yeah.
So, it failed at first, anyways.
Travis, I just got to stop you there. I love that. I want the new slogan of the Lesser Bonapartes to be, I'm going to say the wrong thing, but basically.
Yeah, there you go.
It's true. I was going to say, like, we are perfectly comfortable with, ballparking.
We ballpark all the time. Just everybody. I work off the academic principle of, you know what I mean. You know what
right.
I mean.
Right. But yeah, there's that... But the way that – what I think is interesting is the way that Charlemagne apportions out the realm, because he's sticking with the tradition of, like, the Franks, dividing up the realm, but he doesn't stick to the usual divisions. Like, it's not that he gives one son Austrasia and the other son Neustria and the other son Aquitaine, but now because the realm is so much bigger, it ends up, I think there's like a few years of jockeying, but it ends up being like basically like the eastern half, you know, which is mostly modern day Germany with like Austria, Switzerland, and parts of Hungary, goes to one son. The western half, which would become France, so like Western Francia, which would become France, to the other. And then, you know, the middle, you know, I don't know if he's chronologically the middle son, but there's, you know, a son gets literally like northern Italy, and then a strip of land going in between his two brothers all the way up to the North Sea, and what had to be the most like nerve-wracking realm to try to take care of.
Yeah.
But so instead of the, so he's bound enough to tradition to divide the realm among his sons, but not so bound to respect the old traditional divisions, which is
also
interesting.
There's another thing is if you want to say why, you know, what in history caused this or that, you could make the argument. You could write a book about Lothar in German, it's like Lothar. The third son, Lothar, that got the middle sliver.
Yeah, yeah.
That directly, you could say, I wouldn't necessarily, but you could say that directly caused World War I, World War II, the Austro-Prussian War, Franco-Prussian War, and then just go back all the way to Charlemagne's direct sons.
Yeah,
Every single French-Germanic war, you know, including, you know, Strasbourg in World War I. Okay, Germans took it, had to give it back. And then, you know, first place, Hitler raged against that in his speeches, you know, that we got to get that Rhine area back. That's Lothar. That's the third son.
That's what I think is pretty interesting about. So Charlemagne is today, he's buried in Aachen, right?
Yeah.
The city of Aachen, which is literally like just inside the border of the modern, you know, Bundesrepublik of Germany. And it's a part of Europe that has been in, respectively, it is changed German to French to God knows who, Spanish hands for centuries. And it's of course, Charlemagne is there in that one, like, just burned over part of Europe that has traded hands everywhere, which is, it's very fitting in a way. And I guess that's part of like, I guess to circle back around as we're winding down here, I'm going to make the counter argument that it is France who deserves to claim, Charlemagne as the true founder. Because, you know what, of all these polities that, you know, existed in the post-Carolingian world, Western Francia was the one that more or less retained its notion as a polity. I say that, but of course, you know, that the whole history of the weak French monarchy and the independent Dukes of Burgundy and the English taking over Aquitaine and all that. But if you're talking about an actual continual state that still existed throughout the whole thing, I think France has a better claim to it than Germany.
Yeah, I could make a counter argument, but I already know the counter argument to that one. but all of the, so the King of Bavaria was a Frank. After Charlemagne, the King of Bavaria was a Frank. The King of Frisians had Frank dukes and lords. There was a Francia in Germany. There still is today. There's a part of Bavaria called Francia, which, you know, that was a dukedom, and Baden and Württemberg and all these, they were all Franks after this, all Franks. One exception, Saxons. And my counter argument to my own argument is shortly, like within a couple generations after Charlemagne, it was the Saxon dynasty that takes over pretty easily. And he actually takes over the power structure that exists, Neustria, whatever. And it's this that then the Franks now then take it back after the Saxon dynasty is only a couple of kings, and then the Franks take back over. But the Franks that take it back over inherit the now fully fledged kingdom of Germany, or Holy Roman Empire almost. And so that is, so there is technically a break between Charlemagne and those later Frankish ones, even though they're all, like, genetically, they're all Franks. The later, Bavarian kings, all Franks. The Prussians, all Franks. Yeah. So all the German nobility, you know, all German nobility, the whole European nobility can all trace their lineage back to Charlemagne, which is, first of all, super, super creepy.
Right.
Because they're literally all related. But the other thing is that if you go back far enough,
we all have to share some sticks of wood in the wood pile, you know.
But they're actually way smaller circles.
Right. That's true.
I mean, if you look at the Habsburg, it's like, nah, I don't think, nah.
Yeah.
So definitely you could be, okay, well, the Habsburg, the emperor, the king of Spain, is just as much a descendant of Charlemagne as is the Queen of England and the Queen of the Netherlands, I wouldn't say they're direct descendants, but yeah, they all got
they have that line.
Carolinian blood in them for sure.
Yeah, and that and what I think is kind of fun. what's kind of fun and for cute about this, like even when the Habsburgs like lose the Spanish throne, so like over in Western Francia, like eventually, like I think there's some more Carolingians than there are. The Robertians come in, and then the Carolingians come back in, and then they get kicked out, and Hugh Capet comes in, and he's kind of like, he's who I would call the first king of France, not Clovis. And I think every French I think that's terrible historiography to claim Clovis as the first king of France. But
that's romanticism. That's what they tried in the 19th century. That's Napoleon. I mean,
right.
Yeah.
And Napoleon, I think we mentioned on the first episode of our, or second or something, early on, who knows how long we've been doing this, but like, you know, Napoleon picked those those decorations from Childeric's grave, Clovis's father. He like, you know, picked that as a symbol.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Hugh Capet and the Capetians, you know, even though like the Habsburgs get supplanted by a Capetian cadet line, the Bourbons are still, it's Carolingian line. It's just, you know, again, it's, you can't escape
exactly.
it. And that's, I think that's kind of, it's kind of a wonderful sort of concrete metaphor for like the massive influence Charlemagne had on the friggin' continent.
Yeah. That's the thing is like, was he the founding father or was it some of his descendants? That doesn't matter. He was the trunk. Like he's seriously, if you go even further back, you can say, Greece is the kernel of European culture and Rome is the kernel of European whatever. I don't even care. But Charlemagne is like, seriously, like, the actual genes from all nobility after him were from him and before not, because, you know, the Carolinians were the house of the palace under the Merovingians. So it doesn't go further back.
Yeah.
Well, even then, I guess they were related to the, they were then married to the Merovingians, but, I mean, it starts with Charlemagne as far as like actual genetics and then the reforms that, in Germany, you see him until Napoleon basically stopped him. You know, Napoleon's the one that finally kiboshed the German way of running their empire, which, can trace its roots back that far, you know, to some degree.
Well, we needn't open up that can of worms. I know, Glenn, you're just shaking your head.
No. I mean, we can't turn this into the History of France podcast. We've already agreed, Daniel.
that's true. We do our once annual January France blowout, and then we move on.
We know we overordered at the factory. We're moving them all this weekend.
Everything's got to go.
It's Friday. All France history has to go. And, you know, we got to make way for the new models in 2016. So I think that's a good way, just kind of ending it on that kind of, cacophonous, clusterfuckian history of European succession history of, nobility. Just the kind of influence Charlemagne did have, and I guess you could say the history of Franks. And that's because learning is fun and fundamental, guys.
And fundamental. Yeah. Yes.
That wraps up part six, Daniel. I don't know if you've been listening to the show, Travis, but this has been quite a marathon of ours. Doing this Kingdom of the Franks and everything, and I've been enjoying your history too. Of course, you go into much better detail than we do in your histories in this time period,
which I just want to say is amazing, Travis, that you do such a cool detailed job with History of Germany when in fact you also do, I think, what a baker's dozen other podcasts as well. Like
it's almost a half dozen now. I record five feeds, so it is is a half dozen, which is kind of insane, but
it's impressive.
Well, that's great, man. So I guess that's a great segue into you want to roll some plugs. I don't know how much crossover audience we have, but now is the time to kind of hype each other up here, Travis. So you want to plug either History of Germany or where people can find you?
Yeah, the one thing I know you mentioned it before, we should repeat that, is that we're both members on Dark Myths, of Dark Myths, yeah. So you can go to darkmyths.org and find most of my shows and Lesser Bonapartes, and there's a ton of other shows there. But yeah, my shows would be History of Germany and the same thing in German. I do it in two languages. And The Secret Cabinet, and that also exists in German, but that one's not me. And there's Bohemican, which is on the Czech Republic, history of Czechoslovakia, Austria-Hungary sometimes, but Czech Republic mostly, because I lived in Prague for 10 years. And then what else? Oh, History of Alchemy was actually one of my first shows. So
that
one's been going on for 3 years now, something. So
that's
the
show that first introduced me to the magic of Travis Dow. Or I was I was very thrilled to find that someone was like actually dedicating a podcast to, you know, obscure sorcery from 500 years ago.
That was, you know, that was one where I was like, I wish I would listen to that. I would listen to that if that existed. I doubt anybody else would, but hey, since it doesn't exist, I'll create it. And that's been a fun ride meeting other people that are interested in all kinds of weird belief systems and whatnot. But yeah, sure.
Okay, let's do that. And so I'll just do that. And then, well, that's a great little crossover event, and we hope you enjoyed fucking six part. We need to do like a couple. We need a couple of one-offs here, Daniel, coming up.
I think we need time to catch our breath before the next big series. That's for sure.
You want to go ahead and tease that series, Daniel?
Yeah. Well, I think the next close look we'll be taking will be at a. You know how much we love the failed proto-reformers on this show. And we're going to be taking a look at a very bizarre episode in Renaissance Florence with Savonarola, the just monstrously puritanical prophet slash, you know, apocalypse bringer slash reformer, maybe? Anyway, it's really, it's a whole lot to unpack, but it should be really, really cool.
Yeah, and so we'll see. We'll get to that in the next series. Maybe we'll have a one-off or two just to kind of turn the hats backwards and just have a little us time before we move into our next deep dive. Until then, go ahead and like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Lesser Podcast, rate, review on iTunes, write us at lesserbonapartes@gmail.com. Don't forget our Patreon subscribers at the $1, $5, and $10 level. We got Carlin's and LB Knights coming up. If you're listening on the day of release, we have an LB Knights dropping this weekend, and we do have that Carlin coming out this month, so now's a good time to subscribe and get an epic fuckwad of content from us. As we like to say.
All right. Anyway, so I hope you enjoyed this show on Charles the Great. I'm sure I'll do another one where I'll kind of break down some of his battles and stuff, and some like a little bit more of a chronological order. But other than that, there'll be this show might be my third or fourth show on the Franks, and I think there'll definitely be one or two more coming. Which means if you don't want to wait, go listen to the Lesser Bonapartes now 6-7 episodes on the Franks, and by then I should be ready. And otherwise, I'd like to thanks Dan and Glenn for coming on the show. This was a lot of fun.
Hey, it was awesome, Travis. This was really really great. We'll have to do it again sometime.
Absolutely, yeah. And other than that, so stay tuned for more on the Franks, and then after this series the Saxons and the Kingdom of Germany properly, and all that good stuff. So thanks a lot for listening to the History of Germany podcast, and have a good evening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.